From 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, welcome to The Art of the Matter. Made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you and from Eskenazi Health. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Buscelli Wallerab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
I'm Sharon Gamble. Welcome to The Art of the Matter. This week, we feature a contemporary musician who's covering a jazz pioneer, a playwright who's also a theater critic, and a band whose members have played in lots of other groups. Don't forget, we'll also have that arts calendar we call
What'll We Do?
All that and more right after the latest news from NPR. Welcome back to The Art of the Matter from 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. I'm Sharon Gamble. Indianapolis is home to one of the most innovative programs for artists in the country. In the late 90s, alarmed by the exodus of too many of our city's creative individuals, the leadership of the Arts Council of Indianapolis got together with the leadership of the Lilly Endowment and created a program to both entice and reward artists to stay in Indianapolis. The program is called the Creative Renewal Arts Fellowship, and it awards individuals stipends of $10,000 over 2 years to allow our artists and arts administrators to explore their craft, refresh their creativity, and recharge their spirits. Contributor Pete Brown invited guitarist and educator John Alvarado, who works for IUPUI, musician and program creator Pam Blevins-Hinkle from our Spirit and Place Festival, and Arts Council of Indianapolis President Dave Lawrence to our studios to talk about this remarkable program.
Every 2 years about this time, four words get echoed throughout Indianapolis amongst the arts professional network. Those four words are Creative Renewal Arts Fellowship. If you are an arts administrator or an artist in central Indiana, you can't wait to hear these words. And we're here with three folks that have all been intimately connected to this fellowship program. First, I'd like to ask Dave, would you talk a little bit about what the Creative Renewal Arts Fellowship is, how it got started, and what its core mission is?
Absolutely. The Creative Renewal Arts Fellowship has been around since 1999. We approached the Lilly Endowment we were seeing a lot of burnout in the arts community in terms of mid-level managers. So this really was a first attempt to look at how we can revitalize and keep our arts administrators working at arts organizations. And the Lilly Endowment was very wise, and they said, let's turn this into a positive and think about renewal instead of burnout. And the light bulbs went off at the Arts Council. And so we went back and sort of re-envisioned and dreamed a little bit about what this is. And it is a 2-year fellowship for artists and arts administrators that have been in their field for 10 years or longer. And for artists, it's artists of all disciplines. So it's writers and dancers and musicians and poets and painters and everybody. And it's structured much like an academic sabbatical, and it's an 18-month, 2-year time period. There are no strings attached. Each fellow gets $10,000, and we award 30 of those, with the sole purpose of whatever it is you need to do to renew and refresh your creativity. Because we believe that if we have our talented artists and arts administrators doing things to enhance their creativity, it's that notion of all boats rise, right? Then we've got a lot more great art to look at and listen to in the city, and that makes the city a more art-filled place for us all to live, work, and play. So we are thrilled. This is now the 10th round of fellowships. So we've been doing this since 99. We have awarded 400 fellowships with over $3.3 million in direct funding. And this is all due to the extraordinary generosity of the Lilly Endowment.
Well, and I think something you said that jumped out to me is it's kind of this no holds barred, anything goes opportunity for artists and arts administrators. I think a lot of folks, and with complete disclosure, I was a recipient in 2011. But we're so used to writing grants and we're so used to filling out documents and paperwork and reports that all are very to the letter. You're explaining what you're doing with the money that you receive, and you have to report on exactly how you did just that. And it's really amazing. And I think sometimes we tend to overthink it when we are applying, because we are thinking it almost as the grants we've done in the past. How did that factor into your guidelines for the rules for the fellowship?
Absolutely. You know, I ran the grant program for a long time, and the best piece of advice that I give to artists and arts administrators is be that kid that finds the $5 in your pocket and dream big. And also, you have to be a little selfish with this, because this isn't like a typical grant. You really have to think about what it is for you personally that is going to get you back to doing what it is that you fell in love with in the first place. What is that, whatever it will be, to get you over that creative hurdle that you're facing right
sure.
now, or a new area of exploration that'll take your art in an entirely new direction. So you really have to, as a applicant, sort of shake off the shackles of what a typical grant application is, and really dream in a new way. And I think that that's when we really see fantastic applications and journeys come forward.
And speaking of journeys, Pam, tell us a little bit about your journey. If you wouldn't mind, start by telling us what your professional role is and how that inspired you to want to apply for the fellowship back in 2003.
Well, currently I'm the director of the Spirit in Place Festival. My 2003 fellowship, there's no question that led me to Spirit in Place. So I've
sure.
been at Spirit in Place now. I'm starting my 12th year with the festival. But at the time that I applied in 2003, I was not at the festival. I was an active musician and choral director, and the fellowship gave me this fabulous chance to explore the relationship between my music and my spirituality. Mm-hmm. And so that led me to really focus on learning chants from lots of world traditions. I learned a lot of skills related to chants, like improvisation and drumming. I composed and arranged chants. I experimented with those in public performance. I also took a 2-week silent retreat at St. Meinrad's Arch Abbey. You know, one of the cool things about these fellowships is you can't possibly predict what they're going to open up in your life. I mean, you write these applications, you dream big, and you go, man, this is cool. I want to try this. And you think you know how that's going to impact your life, but you absolutely don't. And if I were to map out the impact of that fellowship on my life, I mean, it would just blow you away. You know, that is where connecting art and spirituality really came together strongly for me. And there's no question that that led me to already art and community were strongly connected. I added spirituality to that. No question, this is what leads me to the Spirit in Place Festival, which brings the arts, humanities, and religion all together. And I added all these great skills. I got introduced to new ways of learning and performing, exposed to different cultures, other people, expanded my network. It's been one of the most life-changing things I've ever had, is that fellowship.
John, will you share a little bit about your story? Again, you kind of what inspired you to want to apply, and where were you at professionally at that time?
Mm-hmm. Sure. I was a recipient in 2013, so I'm just a few years out from having done it. I'm currently the lecturer of guitar at IUPUI's Department of Music and Arts Technology, and I've been there since 2007. I'm trained as a classical guitarist. My master's and my bachelor degree are both in classical guitar. And I would say it still makes up much of what I do, but what I've always had an interest in also is flamenco guitar. But I had never really been able to completely immerse myself in flamenco guitar. And so my project with the fellowship was to spend the time researching flamenco guitar, its role in music, its relationship to classical guitar, its relationship to how it was cultivated in the south of Spain, and then actually travel to Spain and spend some time there actually exploring the different areas. So I really wanted to go and see where this music had been created and experience the culture and see the locations. So in addition to studying a lot on my own and reading a lot on my own and researching a lot, I also spent about 20 days in Andalusia, traveling around to different cities and going to performances, going to museums, visiting historic sites. And I also studied in a workshop in Sevilla, which is considered one of the birthplaces of flamenco music, in a Estudio Cotalla Flamenco, where I studied with Manuel Barquero and had some great lessons with him. He was born and raised and had worked professionally in that area his entire life. And it was just a really great experience working with him as well. So it was completely eye-opening. I mean, it really just I would echo what Pam said. It was life-altering in a lot of ways, and that it just kind of – it had been a dream of mine for so long. I think I actually mentioned this in my proposal. There's a great quote by Agustin Barrios, Paraguayan composer and guitarist, who said that you need to really live and breathe the art. He said that you can't do art unless you've bathed in the fountain of the culture. Wow. And I hadn't been able to do that in flamenco, you know, at all. It was really, I kind of felt like an outsider kind of interpreting what I had read about. And not to say that you can completely understand a centuries-old tradition in 20 days, but right. I really got a much better understanding of where it came from and to really be immersed in it. And it was just fantastic. And I still talk about it all the time today.
Dave, tell us a little bit of the details, the nitty-gritty. When is the next round up, or should I say, when is the next round of applications due? Is there still time for people to get in on this for other arts administrators and artists around Central Indiana?
There is absolutely time. So when we launched the applications in December, we originally had a January 20th due date, I think, but we have extended that deadline to Friday, February 3rd. Because of the holidays, we wanted to make sure that people had plenty of time to submit their applications. So those applications are available on our website, indiearts.org. It's actually an online system this time. All of our grant programs have gone online, so this will be a new thing for applicants. So I would urge everybody to start early. And if you'd like help with that, there are information sessions that I encourage everybody to attend, and that information is found on the website. And you can also meet with one of our grant staff, too, and have them review a draft of your application, answer any questions you have, and I would encourage everybody to do that before making the final submission by February 3rd.
Contributor Pete Brown with John Alvarado, Pam Levins-Hinkle, and Dave Lawrence. The 2017-2018 Creative Renewal Arts Fellowship application is due on January 20th. Learn more at indiearts.org. You're listening to The Art of the Matter on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. I'm Sharon Gamble. Later this hour, the saxophonist who pioneered bebop, hard bop, and free jazz is the subject of a tribute at an indie venue that was named one of the top 100 jazz clubs in the world by Downbeat magazine. But first, Jolene Ketzenberger talks with Kara Gunthorpe about Gunthorpe Farms, her family's multi-generational business.
First of all, we are on the Gunthorpe Farms delivery truck making your deliveries in Indianapolis. Now, tell me what a regular delivery day is like.
So we leave the farm at 5:30 in the morning. Yeah, and normally our first stop is Trine University in Angola. Then we head to Fort Wayne, hit some cool places like the Golden, 800 Degrees, all those places. Seven Suns in Roanoke, and then we head to Indy. Make it to Indy around 11 or so. And then we spend the day everywhere from Mass Ave to, we go as far south as Greenwood. And then up here, like here we're at Goose the Market. And then we'll head to Broad Ripple, then Zionsville, and then Carmel, and then we head home. So we're lucky to make it home by like 7, 8 o'clock. That's at the earliest.
So that is a very long, very busy day.
Yeah, it's really long. So I do all the driving. It took me a long time to be able to be confident enough to drive the truck, but I do.
Well, now tell me a little bit about yourself and when you started working with your dad, Greg Gunthorpe, who... People are very, he's very well known in the local food community for the Gunthorpe Farms up near LaGrange.
I joke that I've been working at Gunthorpe Farms for 22 years now.
Because that's how old you are, right?
Yeah, so working here for 22 years. I went to Purdue, I studied ag business, food marketing. Dad kind of hinted, hey, maybe you could work with our customers. And then it was like light bulb. And I hurried up and got my degree done in 3 years. Graduated in May and have been working full-time in sales and marketing here for the farm since then.
Now, what do you do in addition to, of course, making the deliveries and interacting with your customers?
In addition to making the deliveries, I joke, really, I'm a truck driver because I make the deliveries, I drive stuff to cold storage, you know, I have all sorts of fun driving this truck around, but I also, you know, contact all of our customers, so I take all of the orders. I reach out to them, I send out newsletters, I keep all of our social media sites updated and our website. Really, I just do a little bit of everything here and there, so.
Well, where are we off to now?
Now we are headed to Cafe Patichou's production kitchen.
All right. Well, here we go.
Yeah.
Well, now tell me a little bit about Gunthorpe Farms and the philosophy that drives that.
So at Gunthorpe Farms, we raise pigs, chickens, ducks, and turkeys, all on pasture without the use of antibiotics. We have a USDA-inspected meat processing plant on the farm, so we do all of our own slaughter. And then we do full fabrication, so everything from whole carcasses down to portioned pork chops, chicken breasts, and then we even do ground products and smoked meats as well. Basically, whatever customized meat cut you need, we can get it to you. And then we do all of our own deliveries as well. So
it is a very big operation for a small family-owned company.
Yeah, it's really big. We're up to around 250 acres here and there. It's always changing a little. But with that, we have 20 full-time employees and around 10 part-time employees. So just on our 230 acres, we're able to support 20 full-time employees, plus, you know, myself included, my brother included, my mom, my dad, my sister, and then all the part-time employees. Like, the local food movement is like rural development at its finest.
You can hear Jolene Ketzenberger's Eat, Drink, Indie Saturday mornings at 11 on WFYI HD2, The Point. Two men face the closing of their business. 3 years later, a former female employee and her friend face a different kind of transition. 3 years after that, the hopes, fears, myths, dreams, libidos, and other needs collide in a life-changing double date that's funny, moving, and surprising. That's the setup for playwright Lou Harry's new work called Clutter, or The Moving Walkway, is coming to an end. Yes, he's the same Lou Harry as the IBJ Arts and Entertainment editor and occasional contributor to this program, and I asked Lou to tell us about Clutter, which will be produced at Theater on the Square through January 22nd.
So, obvious question, was there something that happened to you at an airport that made you come up with the germ of this script? I love the subtitle.
No, actually, the airport connection came later. I tend to write in a strange way, I think. When I work on a play, and these play out over years, mm-hmm. I start with characters, and characters just start talking to each other. And
really?
Story and character emerge from those conversations, and a lot of that ends up disappearing and going away. But as it evolves, themes start to emerge after characters and after situation. And then it's in the rewriting and rewriting that those things pop out. So the ideas that led to that subtitle, The Moving Walkway Will Soon Be Coming to an End, occurred to me because these are all my four characters in this play are all people who have basically been, if not on automatic pilot, at least close to it in mm-hmm. their lives and their careers. Mm-hmm. They've been doing what they've sort of have fallen into things, whether that's falling into a job, falling into responsibility, falling into a marriage, falling into a sort of career path. But now for each of them, for various reasons, that moving walkway has come to an end.
So a relationship is dissolving and a business relationship is also dissolving.
Yes.
And they're related to one another.
And they all sort of interconnect. But when you get to that point, there's one way of looking at it that I now have to take these steps myself, or as another character describes it, you get to the end of the walkway and you're now at the terminal where there's all these options now.
Oh.
And you have to make choices.
Sure.
Rather than just standing there and going along with where you're supposed to go. So that's, but that came 12 drafts later. That came after doing a reading at Indy Reads Books a couple of years ago and doing a reading in New Haven with the New Haven Theater
right.
Company. And even after Theater on the Square asked about producing the play. That came, that piece of dialogue, that piece of the title came later.
And it might evolve yet again.
It could after this. But I think what the folks at Tots are putting on stage feels like the final. Yeah, you know, this is definitely the world premiere of this show. This isn't necessarily a step in the process, I
sure.
don't think.
So I want to go back to, speaking of process, let's go back to process for a minute. So these people are showing up. You know, you're eating your cereal and suddenly someone's talking in your head, or two characters are talking. Do you play a game with yourself? You're like, okay, I can hear these two. I can hear this 47, 48-year-old mm-hmm. man, and I can hear this woman who's been his sweetheart for 20 years. I'm pulling stuff out of the air here.
You're writing a play.
There we go. Do you then say to them, yeah, but you know, this isn't interesting enough. What if she's also related to this guy over here? Is that how it works?
There's a lot of what ifs, and I tend to – that conversation, I tend to do right into the word processor.
Okay.
The dialogue happens as I take. One of the greatest gifts I had in high school was having a good typing teacher. So I can type fairly quickly. So the conversations start and these scenes start. In this case, I had two characters who were in a business that was going under. They knew that it had a limited life left. Mm. And there was sort of a power relationship between the two, although age-wise they're peers. One had the more responsible job. The other was the guy who sort of was more enthusiastic about having the parties and having events and things like that than he was about the work itself.
Did they meet through the company, or does their relationship predate?
See, what's great.
I don't want you to give too much away.
But that's something I give to the director and the cast to work
really?
Out.
Really?
Yeah, there's a lot of that I like doing. I'm really cautious in my rewriting about purging exposition.
Yeah.
Obvious exposition out of it. I get bugged when I'm seeing a play and then, you know, 5 minutes in, two characters saying, well, as my sister, you know that we had this.
Right. It's too much.
We don't need that.
And it doesn't allow the audience to get involved and
exactly.
work it out.
I like plays to make you lean in instead of lean back.
Yeah.
I want them to want to pull that and figure out the relationships as it goes along. In this case, the play is in three sort of major chunks. The first chunk is just these two male characters in this business that's going under. There's reference to a woman who was their receptionist there. The second chunk of it is set in a bar, and it's that receptionist 3 years later with a friend of hers, a longtime friend of hers. The two of them used to be kind of party gals in high school and college together, and it sort of missed that irresponsible fun. In the tracks that they are. Now, the friend there is in the process of possibly separating from her husband.
Okay.
So there's a transitional point there. But all kinds of other backstory weaves. And in the third chunk, which takes place 3 years later, is when two of these characters are married and they fixed up the other two into what becomes a long, dark, I hope funny, but also really interesting night of the soul. As these characters who sort of know each other, sort of don't, clash and almost connect and all of that.
Playwright Lou Harry, his play Clutter or The Moving Walkway is Coming to an End, is on stage at Theater on the Square through January 22nd. Have seen and heard members of the indie band Bullet Points in Lemonheads, Extra Blue Kind, Coolidge, or Beta Male. The chemistry when they got together as Bullet Points, though, is something truly special. Bullet Points opened for legendary Japanese band Shonen Knife a couple of months ago, and WFYI's Melissa Davis and Jill Dittmeyer got the band to come in for a small studio session last fall, too. Here's a taste.
Indianapolis musicians David Hazel and David Barajas have been friends for a long time and bandmates many times over in such notable Indianapolis groups as Extra Blue Kind and Beta Male. Now the two have started a new band called Bullet Points. It also includes musicians Matt Beaumont and TJ Briggs.
We eventually put this band together with TJ and Matt.
We've both played together previously in various projects. TJ was with Dave and Beta Male. And I played with Matt in a couple of tribute groups and stuff, so we knew each other.
It was funny because I got a random text from David one night. He was like, "Hey, do you want to join this band I'm starting?" I'm like, "Yeah, absolutely." Just out of the blue.
Yeah, for me, yeah. It was. I was pretty happy about it because I was kind of a fangirl of the other bands those guys were in. I was glad to be asked. Glad they didn't have any other drummers hanging out.
Yeah, glad they didn't find.
No, we did.
Guitar player.
You did.
You were just better.
With all of the getting together, then breaking up. Is there any sense of loss or regret?
Just like any other relationship.
Right.
Yeah. You can be like, oh, thank God I'm out of that. You soldier on for years if your band is doing well and you're tired of it sometimes. Or start a side project that's just for fun and then ends up being a thing. Or
sometimes they just kind of stop being. not a bad thing. It's just it gets so infrequent, and then
yeah, if your band relationship is healthy, and yeah, you're making good music, then it can be sad when everybody has reasons to not do it anymore. And
if the relationship's good at the end, then there's a good chance you'll meet again, maybe in a different setting, different form, because there's a lot of common threads. That's how that's how we wound up getting connected. As long as the relationship can survive a van.
Somebody should put together like a visual, like a chart that shows every musician in Indianapolis and all the bands they've been in with. There would be lines going, it would just look like spaghetti.
Decided to create its own sound.
It's crucial.
It's essential.
Yeah. It's what we do.
Yeah, David and I have been doing this since we could play instruments, so it was always about writing and performing my band's own stuff.
Absolutely.
And as for the future, fans can expect a few live shows, but plenty of new music.
We're looking forward to writing together as this lineup. Whether that be Dave brings in a song 99% complete, or we kind of hash things out as the four of us. That's what we're looking forward to right now.
WFYI's Melissa Davis and Jill Dittmeyer with Bullet Points. You can hear their full small studio session interview at WFYI/small studio. And Jill, you pointed out to me that they don't actually do gigs all that often.
They really don't. They really got together again and created Bullet Points because they really just like to play music. They like to create their own songs, create their own music, and that's how they get through their day. And every once in a while, they'll do a gig, and they've actually got one coming up. So this is your opportunity to hear them. They're going to be at the Mel over there on Illinois, just north of 38th Street in that Butler-Tarkington neighborhood, Friday, February the 3rd at 9 o'clock. There are three other bands playing that night, including the Bullet Points guys, too. So it'll be a really good opportunity to hear some really good original music from some very, very talented men.
Yeah, and you're going to go by the being renovated Tarkington Park and the new Melody Inn marquee and entryway, too.
Go so early, play new on the monkey bars, and then go into the bar and monkey around.
Well, then, I think that probably signals it's time for that calendar that we call
What Do We Do?
Play on the Monkey Bar. I like the way you think, girl.
It'll be warmer by February 3rd.
It will be warmer by then, indeed. And in fact, I have something that will warm you up at Connor Prairie Tuesdays through Sundays. Through March 12th, they are doing something called Hearthside Suppers. We've talked about these before. It's been a few weeks. But what they are suppers that you might have enjoyed in the 19th century. Don't worry. You don't have to peel the potatoes and slice the carrots.
Kill the animal.
Or kill. No. But it's a way to kind of step back in the past. And you certainly will not be texting at the dinner table if you sign up for one of these. So you're welcome to bring your kids along. But just give them some ground rules. No digital stuff, because they wouldn't have had that in the 19th century.
They might have to wash some dishes. Yeah, and talk, but it'll be worth it.
And
the food's always really
delicious,
too.
Delicious, absolutely. And it's by candlelight, so it's lovely. Find out more at Connor Prairie's website.
We heard from Rob Dixon earlier on the show today, and the busy man is going to be busy again. He kicks off the Hot Jazz for Cool Kids series that takes place downtown at the Indianapolis Public Library. The Rob Dixon Quintet will perform on Sunday, January 22nd at 3 o'clock. He'll have his saxophone and be playing some classic music along with some other talented people too, and that series runs through March. And the Alan Turk Burke Quintet will be coming on in February, and then Charlie Ballantyne, exciting young musician, he'll be picking things up in March again. But downtown at the Central Indiana Public Library.
And you know, I want to let our listeners in on a little secret. You don't actually have to have a child in tow to go to a Hot Jazz for Cool Kids concert.
That's good to know.
Just go and kind of pretend the child stepped out to the powder room. We won't tell on you.
Just tap your toes.
Exactly. Hey, the Writers' Center of Indiana has a whole new round of classes starting up, including starting later this month, a class called Poetry as Memoir, and that will be 5 Saturdays beginning later this month, and you can find out more about that and sign up at indianawriters.org.
Coming to Muncie, at the Pub Theater in downtown Muncie, historic downtown Muncie, it is the world debut of a horror play called Blood and Bougainvillea. And that's really, I think, all you really need to know to want to go and see this production. It's by local playwright Darren Morrell. He's performed here in Indianapolis. He's performed at fringe festivals around the world as well. And this is his homage to gothic graphic horror shows. From the turn of the 1920s in France, with all a little bit of zombies, a little bit of jazz music once again. All this taking place in downtown Muncie, January 13th, 14th, 20th, 21st, 27th, and 28th at 8 o'clock. And he has a Facebook page, Blood and Bougainvillea.
Of course he does.
Just sound it out and you'll find it. Something probably not for the kids.
But I'm thinking you might want to make other arrangements for the kids for that one. That sounds like fun. Images from arsenic and old lace popped into my head as soon as you said that. Hey, at the Crystal DeHaan Fine Arts Center, most people are aware that there's a fabulous auditorium in there, 508 seats, the Ruth Lilly Auditorium inside the Crystal DeHaan Fine Arts Center. There's also an art gallery. Don't forget the art gallery. And the art gallery is home this coming Tuesday, the 17th, from 9 a.m. to 9 p.m., to an exhibit called Letterpress Hullabaloo. It's an invitational exhibition of contemporary printers and bookmakers looking at the continuing practice and historical context of letterpress. And if you're like, letterpress, that feels ever so slightly familiar to me, I need to find out more, this is your event. Go to the University of Indianapolis, to the DeHaan Fine Arts Center, this coming Tuesday, and check out Letterpress Hullabaloo.
You had me at Hullabaloo. If you need to find out something else to do, if we haven't enticed you enough, you can check out the local arts event at the indiearts.org/guide, presented by the Arts Council of Indianapolis Indie Arts Guide. Or we'll be back next week again with that calendar that we call What'll We Do?
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and Central Indiana. Your host is Sharon Gamble. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202, or you can email us at aotm@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on wfyi.org.
You're listening to The Art of the Matter on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. I'm Sharon Gamble. On December 9th, 1964, John Coltrane and his band recorded the album A Love Supreme. It's considered one of the great jazz records of all time. On January 22nd at the Jazz Kitchen, saxophonist Rob Dixon and his band will perform the album in its entirety, as well as some other Coltrane standards. Rob Dixon came to the WFYI studios to talk to the Art of the Matter contributor Mark Allen about A Love Supreme and the tribute concert.
So what do you remember about the first time you heard Love Supreme?
That's an interesting question. I think I was really young, probably at the age of like 7 or 8. So I remember my father playing like A Love Supreme, and I thought it was, it sounded really free to me, you know. The music just sounded like the musicians were kind of exploring, an exploration. I mean, I think that that's the way I put it together at that time.
You know? 7 or 8, this must have, I mean, it had to be either mind-blowing or just too weird, but it sounds like it was more mind-blowing.
Yeah, you know, it was probably a little of both, right? A little mind blowing and a little bit strange because of, you know, it just felt like there were no boundaries in that music. It was, you know, very just seemed like ever expanding, much like the universe, right? So, but it wasn't until later that I realized this, like there was, you know, in this music, particularly the Love Supreme Suite, that is very structured, you know, it's a very structured piece of work. So a lot of times that's the first impression, you hear it and it's like people say, oh, it's free jazz, it's avant-garde. And then when you study it, you say, oh, there's a lot of form to the particular arrangements and the movements and everything. So. And that helps, you know, to actually perform it, because you can have not only music, but then have the roadmap of how it's performed, how it was performed on the recording.
Yeah. And how old were you when you first started to try to play it?
Like 2 years ago. Okay. I never tried to play it as, growing up or in studying in music. You know, there were other Coltrane songs that I would transcribe, but that was something that I kind of just listened to just for the enjoyment of listening to the music. And then it wasn't until 2 years ago where I decided to say, we're going to do, it was the 50th anniversary of the Love Supreme. So it took me about 3 months to transcribe a lot of the solos on that record. And so what I did is I transcribed the music, and then I, when I performed, I just let go and didn't play that. But I had, an idea of the way Coltrane put his solos together, you know, and there's on the second movement, Resolution, there were basically three altered pentatonics scales that he uses, you know, and he has very good phrasing with it. And so you don't actually have to play his notes verbatim, but you can play these three different pentatonic scales and you sound essentially like Coltrane. So that's basically what I did, just take his improvisational devices and kind of use them as I saw fit. So
yeah, that was what I was going to ask you is when you're taking an iconic piece like this, I guess you can go in a couple of different ways. One is to try to play it note for note.
Right.
And the other way is to try to put your own self in it. And it sounds like you're putting a little bit of yourself into this piece.
Yeah, definitely. I thought, like, for me to just play the transcription would just be not exciting. And, you know, since the music just, to me, initially, the first impression, it just screamed exploration, I thought, well, let me try to explore within the boundaries of the improvisational devices that Coltrane used. And, listening to it on the first listen, it sounds like, okay, well, he's just kind of playing really open pentatonics and, you know, but they're very distinct altered pentatonics that he uses on particular songs and very much of a methodical improvisational method to the way he approached this movement. And, I mean, the Love Supreme suite, and that would actually not probably be a listener's impression, but for somebody that plays it, it is a great tool to do it if you can actually perform it, to say, okay, I have all this information that I can access to say, this is how you put this together. So
yeah. One thing I always am amazed, well, there are a couple of things that I'm amazed by about A Love Supreme, and one of them is that although Coltrane's name is on this album, I mean, it's very much a group piece, and the efforts by McCoy Tyner and Jones and Garrison, that's, I mean, it's a group playing together. It's not just Coltrane.
Right. And, I think that was the beauty of just Coltrane when he made all those records. It's like that group, particularly Jimmy Garrison, Elvin Jones, and McCoy Tyner, played so much together that, I mean, I think that they were trying to have just a unified sound. And it really, actually, this record really shows that probably a best example of that, the unity of the group, of everybody knowing where everybody is and trusting each other. You know, when Coltrane plays a phrase, he knows that Elvin Jones is going to do this and, you know, resolve it. And, McCoy fits in. He knows where to everybody just knows everybody. And it feels like that to me on that record, you know.
Yeah. Beyond playing A Love Supreme in its entirety at this concert, what else are you doing?
Okay, so we will probably do what we did. I did it a couple years ago. No, the last movement and Psalm. I blended with Coltrane's Alabama that he wrote a year before that, where it was in tribute to the 16th Street Baptist Church in Alabama, the bombing to the girls, the four little girls that passed away. So Alabama is a tribute that we blended with Psalm. And then we also did Central Park West, which was like a nice, I'm going to probably do that, and which is probably, we didn't do last time, but I'm thinking about what we'll probably do is a version of Naima, because yeah, there's several different ways you can play that. And so those are some of my favorite Coltrane pieces, particularly that lend itself to that that period of where he was in his music, you know.
Contributor Mark Allen with saxophonist Rob Dixon. Rob will perform A Love Supreme along with pianist Steve Ali, bassist Jim Anderson, drummer Steve Houghton, and trombonist Ernest Stewart on January 22nd at the Jazz Kitchen. Showtime is 6:30 in the evening. For more information, visit thejazzkitchen.com. We'll be right back. You're tuned to The Art of the Matter on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. Seth Johnson left Indy to go away to college at Ball State, but he's passionate about Indianapolis and its potential. A Cultural Manifesto's Kyle Long talks musical family tree and more with Seth.
I'm Kyle Long from Cultural Manifesto. I'm joined today by Seth Johnson of Musical Family Tree, an Indianapolis nonprofit that provides resources for local musicians. Seth, thank you for being here.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
And Seth, you have five songs to share with us. Tell us what your first song is.
Yeah. Okay. So these songs that I have in mind are all songs that have kind of been favorites of mine over the years, and I would say kind of contribute to my growth and who I am as a music lover. And the first song would probably be a favorite of many, but A Day in the Life by the Beatles.
I read the news today, oh boy, about a lucky man who made the grade.
The Beatles were kind of when I seriously began listening to music and analyzing it in a more critical way than I had growing up. And that song to me kind of was where I began diving into all sorts of other music, was based around the Beatles and kind of based around that song. My second song, I'm probably going to go with Jump Into the Fire by Harry Nilsson. I discovered that song kind of when I was beginning to come into my own, and I guess just the whole theme of the song kind of was, felt appropriate with me growing up and becoming who I was and pursuing the things that I wanted to do musically and as a journalist.
You can swim the sea.
My third song is All My Friends by LCD Sound System. LCD Sound System is probably my favorite band of all time, and when I think back to my years of growing up, and especially in college, that song was just, I had so many times where me and my friends would just be dancing to All My Friends in a room, whether it was at a party or just by ourselves in a room. But that song is just, I love LCD Sound System, and James Murphy is kind of an artist that I just have always looked up to.
That's how it starts. We go back to your house. You check the charts.
Number four is Heroes by David Bowie. I've had so many favorite artists over the years that I've loved, but of all the recent deaths, there was not really one that hit me as hard as David Bowie. I kind of remember waking up that day and tearing up a lot and being very hit by that. And I don't really know what all it is other than just that he kind of always made me feel like I could be me. And that, I guess Heroes is kind of an example of him being himself.
We can be heroes. Just for one day.
And your fifth and final song for us today, Seth.
Yeah,
Johnson.
My fifth and final song is, I would have to say, the Waterloo Sunset by the Kinks. I've recently just gone through a very big Kinks phase, but the start of that phase happened around the time when I currently live in Fountain Square. When I was touring the apartment that I currently live in now, I had been into really listening to the Kinks all the time. I toured this apartment not knowing that there was a stained glass window in the bedroom of the apartment. And when I walked into that bedroom, immediately in my head, the main part of Waterloo Sunset, "Every day I look at the world from my window," came into my head. And so that song has always just kind of felt like the theme song for my life right now, and where I'm at and where I'm living and the people that I'm around.
Every day I look at the world from my window. Chilly, chilly is the evening time. Waterloo sunset.
And Seth, Seth, I want to let people know you're a very prolific music journalist here in Indianapolis, and folks can read your writing at Nouveau, Indie Star, Indianapolis Monthly, Visit Indy, and most importantly, at musicalfamilytree.com.
Yeah.
Anything else you want to let people know?
Nope, that's it.
Yeah. Okay, good.
Yeah, thanks. Cool.
Here, Kyle's A Cultural Manifesto on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio Wednesday nights at 9 or Saturday nights at 10. Thanks for spending some time with The Art of the Matter on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. I'm Sharon Gamble. Today's contributors included Mark Allen, Pete Brown, Melissa Davis, Jill Dittmeyer, and Lou Harry. You can hear our program twice each week on 90.1 FM, Saturday mornings at 7 and Thursday evenings at 8. If you hear something you like and want to share, go to WFYI.org for our podcast. Next week, we'll learn about an actor who's also a chemist and an art project that helps the environment. And of course, we'll have that arts calendar we call What'll We Do? All of that and so much more on The Art of the Matter here on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Central Indiana and Indianapolis. The Art of the Matter is executive producer Roxana Caldwell, producer Melissa Davis, contributor Jill Dittmeyer, and host Sharon Gamble. The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.